tonight on Arena. Sheila Armstrong on her new novel, Fallen Animals, and ahead of his first ever TV series, we look at the colourful career of Arnold Schwarzenegger. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Sligo-born author Sheila Armstrong published her first collection of short stories, How to Gut a Fish, last year. The collection of 11 keenly observed and slightly unsettling tales, it has to be said, received critical acclaim and was listed for the Edge Hill Prize, the Kate O'Brien Award and the Irish Book Awards, among others. Now Sheila has published her first novel, Fallen Animals, which was inspired by the so-called Peter Bergman case in 2009, when the body of a man was found at Ross's Point in County Sligo. Garthy have never been able to identify him in the 15 years since. In Armstrong's story, a lifeless man is found sitting serenely on the beach of a small village on the west coast of Ireland through a chorus of diverse voices, all of whom have had some kind of contact with the man before his death. The mystery begins to unravel, and delighted that Sheila Armstrong is with me in studio this evening. I suppose just that Peter Bergman, and I'm saying Peter Bergman, and I have to put inverted commas around that because it was an alias, in fact, used by this particular man. Just give us the, for those who don't remember it, the kind of the bones of that case and where it jumped, how that was a kind of a one jumping off point for you, Sheila.
Yeah, it was a really interesting case, and I think a lot of people will be familiar with it because it was so fascinating. A man was found dead on a beach in Ross's Point, County Sligo, one morning. It wasn't obvious who he was, how he had died or how he had gotten there. It became clear that just before his death, he'd been acting quite strangely. The guards were able to track him through his CCTV cameras. And he was behaving really, really strangely, doing things like he gave a false name to the hotel that he stayed in, and he disposed of his belongings before he took that final journey out to the beach. So that was the starting off point for the story, that scene of just a person on the beach who had passed away in a slightly mysterious way. I took it for the novel, but I took pieces of it, pieces that I used and yeah, just used it as a jumping off point.
In some ways, in fact, you know, it's the body being discovered very early on in the novel that is the real, that sets everything in motion. To a certain extent, did you take that aspect of the Peter Bergman story and really, after that, throw a lot of the rest of the details of the real life tale out?
What I was really interested by when I was reading about the case was the witness statements. There were so many people who encountered this man on the last day of his life and saw different things, small little pieces of the puzzle. Each one of them had a different observation that was made about this man. And it struck me that something like that could happen to us every single day. We've no idea which encounter of ours we will be asked to remember in a month, in a year, in a lifetime. We cross paths with so many different people and there's always this ripple effect. And it just so happens in this situation, the cause of the ripple is this man being found dead on the beach.
Yeah, and you're touching on it there. It's all of these witness statements. You have fictional witness statements as part of Falling Animals, which effectively is, we see the lead up, we see the period ahead of this particular event from several points of view. And while they all tally and they do kind of fit together, everybody sees a totally different aspect of the story.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because if I was asked to remember something that happened to me months ago, I would have absolutely no idea. You know, we can't really trust our own memories. They're the least trustworthy things when it comes to any kind of investigation like this. Mm. And also I felt that this man, whoever Peter Bergman was, he went to a lot of effort to die on his own terms. He made the choice to go to that beach to hide his identity. And if I were to write the book from his point of view, I think that would have been unfair to him in some ways. So I was much more interested in the people around him, those who were affected by his life, as opposed to his own story.
Yeah, again, because I wondered about that. When you do take a real life event, albeit that this man remains, that particular body remains the body of an unidentified person, really, what kind of worries you would have about making up a story around something like that.
Yeah, there's always a sense of guilt, I suppose, in that this person, it was a real person. They had a real life. He has a family out there, I'm sure, people who are missing him. As writers, we tend to pick and choose. We you know, I'm sure people who have a writer in their life have seen a part of themselves or a detail reflected in something they read. We can be quite arrogant in some ways. We just assume that we can go and pick and choose from other people's lives, and it's necessary. That's what we run on. Mm. We're like pickpockets. We're taking little details and always making use of them. Yeah. So I think it's a question of respect. If you're respecting your source material and giving it enough thought, then I think it's a fair way to go about it.
Yeah, and I need to be clear too. This isn't about you trying to solve the Peter Bergman case, or indeed even is it about you trying to solve the case or the story of this fictional individual in Falling Animals. It's not a detective story in that respect, although it does have lots of bits of the past coming in on top of it. The multi-voice aspect of it, that linked to me directly into the fact that you had, the first thing you'd published had been that set of short stories. You're smiling even as I say that.
Yeah, I joke and say that this novel is a collection of short stories sellotaped together. I think just in the way I write, I'm really interested in going deep into a certain person or a certain scene or a certain moment, as opposed to carrying something across an entire book. So I think it suited the way I write, but it suited the way I think. I have a really short attention span. I kind of flit around from thing to thing. So from being able to dive into 18, there's 18 different voices in this book and dive so completely into their lives was really, really engaging for me as a writer, much more so than it would have been to follow one story, this man's story from beginning to end.
And I guess when you have 18 different voices and therefore 18 different points of view, it also means that you as an author have to really question every point of view and every aspect of the story. I guess it makes you do that.
It was a difficult lockdown. I spent a lot of time with charts and making diagrams and trying to make sure everything linked up okay. It was a huge undertaking to have those 18 different threads woven through and to make sure that they all run parallel and come together to make a picture that makes sense to the reader. I really hope I've done that. I think the ending might be controversial, but I think it suits what the book is trying to get at.
And I don't want to go there with that because let's let the reader find that bit out for themselves. But there is another aspect to the book that I found quite interesting. And indeed, even as I'm looking across the desk at the cover of the book, it's a very swirling seas and a ship or a boat. It's a fishing boat effectively being tossed around. There are two other real life events, if you like, that are much more obliquely feed into the novel. One of which was two shipwrecks, in fact. The Donegal, which was a research vessel found in the Cod Wars of the 1970s, and the other, the Anika, which was built at the height of the Cold War, a luxurious holiday option for the Soviet elite. Both of which have direct connections with Sligo, which is where you're from.
Yeah, it's really bizarre, and I didn't really know anything about these ships until I started looking into them and spoke to the Sligo harbour master, who was very, very helpful. The Donegal had a really, really strange demise because it was directly opposite my house when I was growing up, and we saw it and we assumed that, you know, when you're a child you think a shipwreck, that means it's ancient from the time of pirates. It's been there for hundreds of years. But that wasn't the case at all. It had only been there. It had crashed in the 80s. And it had crashed because it was on its way down to Mayo to be used in a TV production called The Year of the French. And it was to be disguised as a member of the French Navy during the invasion of 1798 and blown up. But before it got there, it got stuck in a sandbank in Sligo Bay and had been there ever since. It's only recently broken apart.
And how much of was that a part of your visual childhood?
You know, yeah, it was there every day, and it was there. Yeah. We had stories about it, and I think the real story is much more interesting than whatever we came up with.
And then the Russian vessel, what was the connection there with Sligo?
The Russian vessel, nobody quite knows why it came to Sligo. There was a deal made with a Russian businessman, some kind of shady undertaking in the 90s, to convert it into a floating hotel, which is apparently a thing for very wealthy people who jet off in their speedboats and go and stay in the Indian Ocean, the height of luxury. So it was brought to Sligo. known for its, you know, luxury apparently during the 90s, to be retrofitted, but the deal fell apart. And the ship changed hands a few times. There was some interest in making it into a ballet stadium. Another one, it was a Sligo businessman wanted to turn it into a floating nightclub, which I would have absolutely loved growing up, going out onto the docks. But all these plans fell through. Yeah. And then eventually the ship actually went on fire.
And all of that, in again, as I say, in quite oblique ways, both of those stories feed into the backstory to what may or may not have happened in this particular case. But what interests me in this, when I think of your collection of short stories, How to Gut a Fish, and which again is set in and around the sea, obviously Falling Animals has a big seaside aspect to it, and certainly the boats that would be coming in and out of Ross's Point, a big part of the, well, of whatever the fictional place in your book is, a big part of the story. How important is that call of the sea to you in your writing in particular, Sheila?
I find it's the thing that comes easiest to me. I grew up, I spent a lot of my time on the sea and in the sea, and it's almost my default. When I sit down to write, it's never really a character that comes to me. It's the landscape. It's imagery. It's emotion tied to setting. I think landscape is what I love to write about, and obviously the sea is just so many different changing moods and so much history attached to it that you can really, you can superimpose any kind of story onto it.
And again, I don't want to give away the particular way you stage the ending of the book, but this idea of the sea kind of being a force and a life-giving and a life-taking force all of its own seems to be a very important aspect. And yet you're based in Dublin now.
Yeah, based away from the sea, which hurts me.
Well, away from the Atlantic Ocean,
yes.
The people in Dublin will be quick to tell you the Irish Sea is there.
It's not quite the same. It's a lot colder. I think growing up by the sea, you have a lot of respect for it. You have a love for it, but also a lot of respect. And you know both the worst and the best of it. In a lot of ways, you know that it can take life, it can take everything from you, but it can also give you so much.
So what happens now? Is the sea calling you for whatever book number three is, a set of stories or another novel?
Well, I might, just to change things up, set it in a desert. I'm not quite sure yet. But yes, another novel.
Another novel is on the way. Well, in the meantime, Sheila, congratulations on the current one and best of luck with it all. That's Sheila Armstrong. The novel is called Falling Animals, out now, published by Bloomsbury. And Sheila, along with author Michael McGee, will be in conversation with Patrick Frayne at the International Literary Festival Dublin. That's in Merrion Square. It takes place this Thursday, the 25th of May at 8 p.m, that particular event. And you can find out full details on ilfdublin.com. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. A treat awaits the audience at the National Concert Hall this Friday evening when the Estonian conductor Mihail Gerts makes a welcome return to conduct the National Symphony Orchestra. On the menu will be an orchestral homage to Estonian folk song by composer Edward Tubin, and in this the year marking the 150th anniversary of his birth, two works by Rachmaninoff. And here to talk through the programme with me is conductor Mihail Gerts. Let's start with Rachmaninoff, because he really is, he's holding this programme up, if you like. He's the two big bookends in some ways. The 150th anniversary of his birth. Where does he sit in your musical life, I suppose, Mihail? How important is he?
Quite important, I would say, being myself a pianist. I, of course, grew up with that repertoire of études tableaux, of piano concertos. I never played them publicly, but of course, through this music, through his vocal music, I got to know him very early with my own fingers, so to say. And then over the choir music of Siena Schnebdenia, over the midnight vesper, it has always been present.
And you really pick up on two big aspects of Rachmaninoff and what you've just said, one being that choral aspect, if you like, and the other being the piano music. I see one as, you know, the big romantic, the high romance of the piano, and yet the choral music has a much more contemplative feel to it. But the two sides are essential to understanding Rachmaninoff.
Absolutely. It's a very, very good remark. I never thought of it in this way. But as you say, Sean, these are his, maybe to say, the biggest contrasts. Very virtuosic writing for any instrument in the orchestra. In Bells, we'll hear the most virtuoso playing. It's so dense in texture, sparkling, brilliance. Every instrument has really a lot to show. And then also moments of restraint, of utmost restraint, in terms of inner, let's say, even introvert contemplating, as you say.
Because In the Bells, which is it's the big work that you're performing on Friday evening, it will be the second half of the concert. Mm-hmm. In the Bells, you essentially have four movements which bring us from birth through to death and beyond, in fact, in what Rachmaninoff is doing here. The significance of the bells here, or bells in general, for Rachmaninoff. Of course, bells toll when somebody dies, bells ring at celebrations. Was there a particular relevance for Rachmaninoff?
Yes, this is the figure which accompanied him throughout all his life. And it's also presented like that in the work which we are going to perform. So in the piano music, even if we think of the prelude, C sharp minor, it's still the bells, bum, at the beginning of the second piano concerto. So this kind of presence of the bells is omnipotent.
Yeah, so even if there aren't bells in the orchestra, he will have bell-like sounds either on the piano or on some other instrument. Let us listen to the opening of the very first movement of the bells. And this is birth and the beginning of life and youth and all of that exuberance, all expressed, I think, in this particular movement of the work. I just wanted to let the vocal music establish itself a little bit there in the opening movement, The Bells, the music of Rachmaninoff in that recording that we were listening to there. It is that piece, that wonderful work that will be performed by the National Symphony Orchestra on Friday evening with Mihail Gertz conducting the orchestra, and he's with me in studio now. It's astonishing what happens in the space of a couple of minutes there. You talked about the textures of the orchestra.
Yes, we could hear that. We could hear this virtuosic, which is never for the sake of virtuosity. It's just because it's all erupting from Rachmaninoff. He's thinking so fast. He has it all in himself, and it all has a meaning for him. He's not showing off. It is just like that.
But what amazes me, even in listening to that little section that we were listening to, how you have that like very big forces of the orchestra, and then it all suddenly we're down to the single tenor, just that single note of the tenor voice coming out above it all, and it's down to nothing from huge forces.
Exactly. Wonderful shaping and using those forces, those huge forces, which I'm very much looking forward to meet, the 125 singers of the National Symphony Choir. And of course, every meeting with the National Symphony Orchestra is also a big joy for me. So, and with our soloist.
Yes. Yeah, because the soloist we should mention who will be performing on the night, the tenor who will be performing the role that we just heard is Valentin Dityuk, and the baritone who performs in the later work is Andrei Bondarenko, and a fellow countrywoman of your own is the soprano who is performing the second. She's in the second movement mostly, isn't she?
Exactly. Yeah? This is the most tender movement which paints, let's say, the pre-wedding moment, the wedding, basically, the wedding bells. And that's why I wanted this voice to be exceptionally tender, really, at the same time, of course, carrying and a strong voice. But I think it suits Miriam Mesak, very well.
I'm guessing that maybe there's an Estonian quality that, if I'm not being narrow-minded, to think that there is an Estonia, a type of Estonian voice. But choral music is hugely important in Estonia. Folk song is hugely important in Estonia.
Exactly. And this is also why I wanted to, when Symphony Orchestra asked to do something Estonian, to addition of the Isle of Death and the bells, then I proposed the work by Edward Tubin, And I'm so happy that the orchestra accepted it and we can present it here in Dublin, because this is such a particular connection. They actually met Tubin and Rachmaninoff. They met when Tubin was in 1938 on his learning trip to Budapest and Vienna, where he met Kodály. He also listened to a concert played by Rachmaninoff. And Rachmaninoff played Bach, and Tubin recalls that he has never heard piano playing like that before and after in his life. Every voice was alive. Every voice was living and speaking. And Tubin is the greatest Estonian symphonic composer. I would dare to say that of the same skill level. They were both very well taught, Rachmaninoff and Tubin himself also, in all the disciplines of composing. And the Sinfonietta on Estonian Motifs is one of his youth works by Tubin, from the period where he collected the folk songs, where he was writing first Estonian ballet. But even there, we can really hear his masterful symphonic writing.
The name Tubin would not be that well known outside of Estonia, I think it is safe to say. And it's probably thanks to Nemi Järvi, the conductor, who really brought his music to light in the 80s and 90s, I think, to a wider audience. But was Tubin doing with folk music in Estonia maybe what Sibelius and Grieg were doing in that part of the world, taking those folk tunes and changing them into something else? Was he very much part of that movement?
Absolutely. It's a very good remark. Sibelius was, of course, a big, let's say, example to orientate for Tubin. Tubin even wrote articles about Sibelius and called him the greatest living composer in 1945, when Sibelius turned 80. So the ideal treat of folk music for Tubin was Bartok, as you said, taking those elements and transforming them so that you don't recall necessarily a melody, a folk song tune, but it's incorporated into the orchestral texture. So it is quite a lot of really craftsmanship, which is demanded to do it, but they possessed it, and that's why it's wonderful.
Well, I know that you have to go and have your first rehearsal, in fact, with the 125 members of the chorus in the next couple of minutes, so I'm going to let you go and do that. But I'm wondering, to what extent will, in fact, you know, will Maria Messak in particular, and perhaps Estonian members of the audience who might be listening or who might be there on Friday night, will they be singing along? Are these folk songs that they will really know, or are they transformed so much that they're barely recognisable?
They for sure won't be singing along, because it takes too much knowledge, really, to identify them. But they would recognise, and I think everyone in the audience will recognise just the colour, the dance-like colour, even of the third movement, let's say, of the Sinfonietta or of the first movement. So it's unmistakably folk song, but the words, there is no way.
Nobody will be singing. However, they will get to listen, and let us finish by listening to a section from that third movement, which gives us the colours that you're talking about, the Sinfonietta on Estonian Motifs, one of the three pieces that will be performed on Friday evening by the National Symphony Orchestra at the National Concert Hall. I'll give you out full details after we listen to this. That's a section there from the third movement of Eduard Tubin's Sinfonietta on Estonian Motifs, and that is one of the three pieces that the National Symphony Orchestra will be performing on Friday evening, with Mihail Gertz conducting at the National Concert Hall this Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eduard Tubin's Sinfonietta on Estonian Motifs, two works by Rachmaninoff, including the bells, with the National Symphony Chorus and Soloists. Full information and tickets on nch.ie, and if you can't make it there, you can listen to the concert live on RTE Lyric FM. The Royal Hibernian Academy and the RHA, located on Ely Place, just off St. Stephen's Green, has launched its annual exhibition showcasing contemporary artists from all over the country in its 6 gallery spaces. All of the artworks were installed over the weekend. The exhibition formally launched yesterday. Olin McGann paid a visit to see what was on offer and talked to a few artists, and he's with me in the studio this evening. This exhibition, Olin, the RHA itself and this exhibition, it's a hugely important annual exhibition.
It is. I mean, the RHA is now 200 years old. It was 1823 under the stewardship, I guess, of the Viceroy Earl Talbot in 1823 when it first kicked off. A member-led academy, all artists promoting Irish art, artists from all over the country. It's the 193rd. In those 200 years, they have staged 193 annual exhibitions, and they really are some of the cream of Irish artistic talent, but also invitees and also not necessarily professional artists who submit. They had 2,700 online submissions this year, which they whittled down to 800. Now, that's based on seeing them online. Mm. Those 800 are then brought in, and the panel of 6, who's chaired by Abigail O'Brien, who the first female president of the RHA, a 6-person panel then whittled them down to 380, which is a vast amount of work.
It certainly is. Yeah, and there's 6 different gallery spaces here.
Six different gallery spaces.
What meets you when you go in the door? Is it a barrage on the senses?
No, even the main entrance is lovely because it's a gallery space in itself, and you go in. Now, anybody familiar with Colin Davison as a portrait artist will immediately see one of his paintings over to the left. Right beside him, Colin Martin, is a picture of like innumerable Glastonbury tents that he's painted. But right in the middle is this beautiful hand. That's how I'll describe it. Mm. It is just a beautiful white stone hand. And this is from Imogen Stewart, who's the oldest at 96.
We're going to tweet that image as we're listening now.
Yeah.
So at RTE Arena, if you want to see the image. So tell me a little bit more about Imogen. You spoke to her, yeah?
Imogen is the oldest exhibitor at the exhibition at 96. And as you can hear, she's very proud of that fact.
There's no doubt about it that I'm the oldest. I'm 96 now.
We're sitting right beside a sculpture that you've done. Can you describe the hand that we're sitting beside right now?
Yeah, this hand, I have a very good stone carver, but my idea, I carved a lot of hands in different positions. It seems to be, I notice it myself now, that it is a subject which I use a lot. For instance, also for the church. In the church, for instance, Stations of the Cross, I have carved loads of just hands.
It's stone. I'd say it's about 60 centimetres.
It's Portuguese limestone. And he carved it beautifully.
And do I do the design. You do the design. And who's your carver?
Phil O'Neill. 5 generations of stone carvers.
And where?
5 generations of stone carvers. Isn't that something? He chooses it. Sometime now it's very difficult to get the right stone, we find. And we use a lot of granite.
It's very, very smooth. It's very, very precise.
Very, yes. You can do that with granite, but it's not so attractive. Granite is different.
And what are you trying to say with the piece of art? What does it mean for you?
You see, there was a time, especially in the church, I didn't like using faces always. And I found them, hands are much more interesting and expressionistic. I don't know whether that's the right word, but it gives you a much more interesting expression. You can do an awful lot with hands.
Well, it's certainly on very prominent display. It's right in the middle of the floor as you come in.
That it's this year here, where we have a special 200 years of academy, that this should be here in front of it, like a welcome, as a welcome.
And that's Imogen Stewart there speaking to Olin McGann at the RHA yesterday. I think it was, you were in, Olin, wasn't it?
Sunday.
And that hand, very striking image. And as you said, sitting in the middle of the floor, I guess, do pieces, because it's such a big exhibition, do pieces jump out at you?
It's funny that people are inclined to go towards the walls immediately. Mm. So anybody who's going on, I'd ask them to just take their time and see what's right in front of them, almost under their feet. Because a lot of the sculptures are quite small, and it is worth kind of, you know, spending a little bit of time. But there's no missing the hand. Apart from that, like when I was upstairs, there was a piece by Alice Marr.
We might tweet that image now. This is Mary Magdalene talking to her hair at RTE Arena is where you will see that image that Olin is talking about now.
And when you see it at the exhibition, it's the detail that you'll pick out. This is paper, charcoal, chalk and pencil. I spoke to Abigail O'Brien about this. It's part of an ongoing theme that Alice is exploring around the image of hair, and hair being power and female sexuality. And Mary Magdalene, of course, would have been seen as a figure of danger. So.
Of course, she was involved in that big exhibition out at Rua Red in Tala that had Mary Magdalene as a big theme within it.
Yeah, and this is very much her as a powerful woman and representing that. In the main gallery again, you cannot miss the piece by Liam Belton called Humans. Liam is a member of the Academy. I don't have an image of this, unfortunately. It is vast. It's a massive collage of images of people who are generally, you think, displaced. There are things like boots and hats and stuff. It really reminded me of the Ellis Island Museum in New York, where you get all these pieces that the immigrants into America had left behind.
Now, there isn't an individual curator here, and I mean, it's such a vast body of work that has to be chosen from and then hung, that's another task.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there are six curators in that, the panel of six whittled it down to 380, but Donald Teskey, who has two paintings at the exhibition himself, he was in charge of hanging all the paintings and where 380 and all the different walls. So I spoke to Donald about this, and I started by asking him what his role in the exhibition was. You know, not as a curator, as you say, but he was something else, like I suppose a placement artist in many ways.
My role is to lay out the exhibition, particularly all the works on the walls, and to make them look the very best and try and create, you know, be as respectful as I possibly can to every artist.
Is there a methodology to that?
There's a kind of general layout where the work, after it's been selected, the crew distribute the works within the five or six galleries of the Academy, and there's a kind of a general theme that the main gallery takes the members' pieces and invited artists.
Yeah.
That's not strict, but that's generally where they go. So I have a kind of working method in that sense. I know what's going into the main space. But of course, every year is going to be a surprise.
Yeah.
And also, what my role is to try and make it as fresh and exciting every year.
So how long have you been doing this?
Well, I think it's about the fourth year. And there's always a risk that they can roll into each other, you know, in your memory. Because the members, by their nature, are showing their work, and if it's the same members each year, you tend to see great examples of their works.
Just inside the patio window here, we have a huge wall of very, very small paintings, probably 60 or so paintings who are quite small here.
That's the Great Wall, I suppose you'd call it. I think it's the wall that people love to hang on. It's so easy to see the works as well, and they tend to bounce off each other. You know, there's a great kind of interaction, great dialogue between the work, and I think it's a very exciting wall. But it also allows for a lot more artists, because of the size of the works being selected for that wall. It allows, you know, more artists to be in the show.
Okay, and photography as well is part of the exhibition.
Photography is part of the show, and that's something that's been really come into its own in the last 10 years. A lot of serious photography accepted into the exhibition.
And in the main gallery, there are some enormous pieces as well.
Yeah, this year in particular is a year where people really up their game, I think. The members, again, just come back to the members' work. But there's also a fantastic architectural installation, which was actually curated by Peter McGovern, who is our architect member. And that sort of really influenced the hang and the placement of work within that exhibition room.
Donald Teskey there speaking to Olin McGowan about the hanging of the RHA annual exhibition. Just wondering, Olin, we've spoken about paintings, we've spoken about the sculptor aspect of things. Are all media represented here, if you like? Are all different art forms or types of art representation present?
No, I was talking to Abigail. They don't do video art, because in Abigail's opinion, you need an isolated space to do visual art. And this is a very, very busy exhibition. This really attracts a lot of people through it. So they have vast open open spaces. Once once a piece is finished and once it is of high quality, you can submit it. And there's a huge amount, as I was saying, of sculpture in the... So Vera Clute, the artist Vera Clute.
Yeah, let's tweet an image of Vera's particular piece that she's going to talk about, I think, here as well, at RT Arena, to see the Vera Clute image nest.
Yeah, she was essentially the 3D, what they call the 3D, which is the sculpture. Mm. She was the 3D version of Donald. So she curated all the overseeing of where all of the sculpture was placed. So similarly, I asked her about what that process involves.
It involves moving everything back and forth quite a lot because so much different work. Do you know, you can't really categorize anything. Do you know, it's an open submission, so you don't know what you get. So you have a bunch of things that really don't fit together, that don't make sense together. So it's a lot of moving things back and forth and just to see, does it look good there? Does it look good there? I think you have to go with your gut feeling in the end. I mean, you know yourself when you see it, but I guess sometimes you try to make connections visually if something has a similar color or similar shapes or things like that, or sometimes content-wise, if the theme kind of relates to another piece, you place them together. So there's no right or wrong way, I guess.
And what has particularly struck you this year in terms of the sculpture?
I think every year I'm just amazed by all the different stuff that comes in. There's no repetition in it, really. I think we might be showing the same artists again over the years. Yeah. But each year is different, each year is new.
Of course, you can't miss Imogen's hand when you come in today.
Yeah, that's a brilliant piece. Yeah, I was speaking to her last night about that. I think she was saying it was a part of a bigger assembly of three hands, so she's reusing that. And I guess putting that into the entrance, you know, that...
Oh, it works. it works.
Vera Clute there. Just finally, that's about at the RHA exhibition, speaking to Olin McGowan. Finally, Olin, and this is very topical indeed,
oh, yes,
isn't it? We have an AI image, which we're going to put up, artificial intelligence, at RTE Arena to see this. What is it?
This is a piece of work by, well, the artist, now this is where I'm confused, the artist is credited as David Lester Mooney, who is a filmmaker. The piece is called Throwback Selfie, hashtag Magdalene. It's an image of four women looking at you. It's quite eerie. It is very, very arresting. And when I spoke to Abigail, who chaired the panel, I said, this is controversial. And she said, look, when they saw it, they were immediately taken by it. Then they found out they had selected it, then found out it was AI. It wasn't hidden that it was AI.
Yeah,
because they saw them, you know, without knowing the artist,
they judged them blind.
So they decided, look, we'll put it in there. It's the only AI piece in there. So really, if you're going along, you make your own mind up, not just about the piece of art, but about, you know, whether it should be there in the
even first. In the small thumbprint that I see of it, it is quite an arresting
it
image.
I'm interested
to see it in place as well. Good way to spend an afternoon. I think you enjoyed yourself.
Very definitely. It runs until July 30th. It opened officially yesterday.
Okay,
it runs all the way through the summer.
It launched, as Olin said, May 22nd, all the way through the summer, through until July the 30th. From his humble beginnings in Austria, Arnold Schwarzenegger's journey to superstardom began with his insatiable passion for bodybuilding. Schwarzenegger claimed multiple titles, including the prestigious Mr. Universe and Mr. Olympia crowns. He then burst onto the scene as an action movie superstar with starring roles in The Terminator, Predator, Total Recall and Kindergarten Cop. But Schwarzenegger's journey didn't end in Hollywood. In 2003, he became the governor of California, temporarily calling a halt to his film career and embracing American politics. He has since returned to the big screen with his former rival Sylvester Stallone, but he will make his small screen debut this week in his first TV series, FUBAR. I'm joined by David Hanratty to look at the career of the Austrian Oak, as he is referred to. That early life and upbringing, what sort of a childhood was it, and what kind of family connections did he have?
It's a very strange one, yeah. I will say, like, the Austrian Oak is an incredible name for an incredible man.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, at one stage in his career, he was hanging out with the likes of the now late superstar Billy Graham, who would go on to be, like, one of the great, most charismatic professional wrestlers of his day. But the early days for Schwarzenegger were very, very interesting and very, very difficult as well. So he's born in Austria in 1947. And, you know, something that was talked about in his life, but something only he kind of recently publicly reckoned with about a year ago, is that his father, Gustav, was actually a member of the Nazi Party and served during World War II. And was definitely present during horrific atrocities, although the level of his participation is disputed to this day, and it's kind of impossible to determine what exactly he did do. Schwarzenegger has said publicly about his father that he came back a broken man and he was full of guilt and he was trying to ward people off. This is when he was speaking out last year on St. Patrick's Day about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and trying to ward people against that path and the path of the far right. So Schwarzenegger himself is very outspoken, very anti-Nazi, which can only be applauded, and, you know, using his platform for that. But the young Schwarzenegger was, I mean, he desperately wanted to go to America, which he would do by the time he was 21. He found himself obsessed with the idea of bodybuilding and essentially kind of put that on the map, you know, on a global scale eventually. And again, I think we've all come across Schwarzenegger in different forms, but those forms were always this Herculean physique that he possesses to this day. Like, he did a recent interview where he was complaining about how he doesn't look how he used to look, and it's like, he still looked pretty good for a man of 75. Like, yeah. I mean, he looks unbelievable. But yeah, he had a tough upbringing. He spoke about, you know, how he was just kind of grew up in a very kind of militaristic world, and, you know, he would have suffered what he has compared to child abuse in terms of being beaten if he ever stepped out of line. And his charisma wasn't suppressed, though. I mean, like, he managed to kind of get out of there and become...
That stayed intact in the midst of it all. Let's have a listen to a clip from the 1977 documentary Pumping Iron. And here's Schwarzenegger explaining what the pump is. And it also gives us a sense of just how disciplined he was in this particular aspect of his life.
The greatest feeling you can get in a gym, or the most satisfying feeling you can get in the gym, is the pump. Let's say you train your biceps. Blood is rushing into your muscles, and that's what we call the pump. Your muscles get a really tight feeling, like your skin is going to explode any minute. You know, it's really tight. It's like somebody blowing air into your muscle. It just blows up, and it feels different. It feels fantastic.
That's Arnold Schwarzenegger there in the 1977 documentary Pumping Iron. We're profiling the great Arnie this evening on Arena with Dave Hanratty. You do get a sense that there's a very disciplined mind in there and a very gentle guy speaking to the camera.
He's a natural, even in this one, yeah. And Pumping Iron is a weird kind of cult favourite amongst people who aren't even into bodybuilding whatsoever. And, like, this film kind of focused on his path and his rivalry with Lou Ferrigno, who went to play the Incredible Hulk, and how Arnie was looking to, I think, win his sixth Mr. Olympia at that point. He would go on to win it. Spoilers for Pumping Iron from 1977 there, sorry. Still worth checking out, though. And then, you know, Mr. Universe, all these things. You know, like, he had this unbelievable competitiveness and discipline.
And... how easy was it to transfer that particular discipline into the discipline of acting and screen acting?
It took some time because, I mean, Pumping Iron comes out in 77, but he did appear on the big screen before in 1970 in this terrible film Hercules in New York. And, you know, even the title lets you know you're not going to be seeing a classic. His voice is overdubbed. He looks like he's learning on the job. He's still a very young man at this point. And by the time, like, he went to the US when he was 21 and he didn't have much English. So he is kind of learning by doing. But it all changes in the early 80s when he appears in Conan the Barbarian. Now, that film wasn't terribly well reviewed, but it was a box office success. And from there, it just becomes this fusion of this unbelievable charisma in the likes of which we've never seen before. Some people will say that he's not a great actor. I'd actually disagree. I think he does have chops.
What the Terminator, like, that was the explosion, really, was it?
I think so, yeah. So the Terminator is 84 and he plays this cyborg killing machine. Doesn't have a lot of dialogue, doesn't need it. He has some famous lines, of course, but his presence is unbelievable. And that's an incredible film. I rewatched it recently and it holds up exceptionally well in 2023. Yeah. It's a horror film, it's a sci-fi, and Arnie is the poster boy and he's amazing in it.
Well, here he is from the first Terminator film, playing the title role, of course, enters the police station to find Linda Connor, who he has been sent back in time to kill, the way the film works.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. I want to wait. There's a bench over there.
I'll be back.
It doesn't matter how many times you hear that line. It's still brilliant. That's Arnold Schwarzenegger in the very first Terminator film. Dave, I was just saying as we were listening to that clip, It's easy to think, sure, he was a big, hefty bodybuilder, wooden as a plank, and therefore the acting is going to be wooden as plank. But wooden and deadpan are not the same thing.
No, not at all. He has that kind of weird gravitas. I mean, he's got an amazing voice, like, let's be fair. Like, it sounds like nothing you've ever heard before, and he does it incredibly well. And yeah, like, that kind of debate that still rages about, you know, well, like, he's a movie star. Can a movie star and an actor, you know, can they coexist? I think he's got range, and I do think that in those roles... who else would you believe as this, as the Terminator character? And the fact that, you know, in 91, when the sequel comes out, they flip it and he's the good guy. Yeah. And he has that charm. He has that warmth.
He can carry that off, yeah. But then the warmth really comes with Kindergarten Cop. I mean, you can't even say the name of the film without smiling.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And it's still, people still watch it, you know, to this day. And again, but that's another thing where, like, he's this macho star. And he helped pave the way for kind of people laughing at themselves and showing that he can kind of be the fool. And again, in that film as well, shocking amount of range there and what he's doing with himself. Like Jim Carrey probably took some notes on what he was doing.
Well, he should have taken notes on a still face from Arnold Schwarzenegger. He could have taken a few of those notes. Anyway, let's stick with Arnold for the time being. Kindergarten Cop, playing John Kimble, police detective, working undercover as a preschool teacher. What a setup. He's trying to locate the wife and child of a drug dealer, of course. But here he is, finding out about what happens when you go into kindergarten and you think you're in charge.
Now we're going to do something extremely fun. We're going to play a wonderful game called Who Is My Daddy? And what does he do? Yes?
Is your daddy a fireman? He's probably big. Is he a wrestler?
Is he a basketball coach?
No.
What's the matter?
Oh, I have a headache.
It might be a tumor.
It's not a tumor. It's not a tumor at all.
He's hilariously funny.
That voice, you cannot laugh.
And I'm also thinking, what was the one where he was expecting the baby with Danny DeVito?
Junior. There's twins as well.
Twins, yeah.
But the fact that he was able to just not just be the action guy and actually lean into this kind of comic persona and do his comic timing is not easy, and he's got it.
He certainly has. What about, however, what was on the rivalry with Sylvester Stallone? And I mean, how manufactured was that? Because they are the best buddy. Well, they certainly became kind of buddies later on in life, didn't they?
They're good friends now. And they did actually have a business venture along with Bruce Willis. They owned the Planet Hollywood series of restaurants that were kind of all the rage in the 90s. I don't think it's manufactured because they seem to genuinely jaw at each other. There was real tension there and they wanted to both be number one. Stallone did an interview there about a year ago with a Hollywood reporter, and he talked about this, you know, kind of famous rumor that there's a film called Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. It's absolutely terrible. It's garbage. But what happened was there was a rumor that Schwarzenegger had put the word out on the street that he wanted that script. He said it was the best script going. It's going to be great. It's going to make so much money and do this for me. Stallone got wind of this and said, no, I'm doing that one. And of course, did it. Arnie sat back, watched him do it, box office failure. And it's been confirmed now by Arnie saying that, yes, I did in fact do that. But it's fine. We're friends now. And isn't that good? Because the world doesn't need that film to ever have a sequel of any kind. So it was a genuine rivalry. They didn't like each other.
And that is political chicanery of the highest caliber from Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governator, as he then became. What about that foray into politics? How did that factor into and out of his acting work?
Well,
Ronald Reagan, of course, lots of actors have done it, but Ronald Reagan being the obvious example.
Yeah, who Arnie kind of showed public support for. He is a Republican, a moderate Republican. Yeah. He also showed support for George H.W. Bush. It took him off the big screen for a while. It was floated in 99, and he said, no, I'm still going with the career. Everything's fine. Kind of had a bit of a box office downturn from then. 2003, he's on the Jay Leno show, and he says, I'm doing it. I'm running for governor. He gets in. He does one public debate. That's about it. Gets in on a recall. You know, all the headlines, they're all like, tell a recall. Here he is. And by that point, he kind of hung up the boots for a while. He appeared in Terminator 3 in 2003, but then it was pretty much just politics for a bunch of years. Didn't do all that much, but you're the governor of California. It's a bit of a figurehead role. And even Republicans criticized him, said he wasn't good enough of a Republican. He wasn't right wing enough for them. He had contradictions as well, because he appeared to be a force for good in some respects. You know, he spoke out about gay rights and pro-choice, but then he would knock down bills that would help those people. Mm. So your classic kind of American political tale. But he somehow came out of it mostly okay, despite some personal life scandals along the way, which dogged him a bit.
Oh, yeah, and did he recover from those?
I think so. I mean, his career, he went back to cinema in the 2010s with some middling films, but again, people still welcomed him back in. You know, I think he has that kind of weird, reckless charm to him that even though he is guilty of some bad behavior along the way, that he has apologized for. you could argue perhaps not profusely enough, but ultimately people still kind of welcome him into their homes or on the big screen. He's not the draw he once was. He couldn't possibly be. The 80s and the 90s were, without question, his kingdom. But the politics thing didn't seem to really derail him too much.
All right. And of course, he's back in the news now because of the upcoming FUBAR, which you did explain to me what the acronym means, and please don't explain it on air. FU is the first bit you can work out. Beyond all recognition is the rest of it.
Yeah, we'll say messed up beyond all recognition.
Okay. What can you tell us about this embargo until Thursday? So what little can you tell us about it before we hear about it on Netflix?
First major TV show for the man, very similar territory to True Lies, if you've seen that film, which is one of his better ones from the 90s. And it's very much him leaning into comedy once again, and kind of action comedy, right, and his age and all that kind of stuff. And he seems to be fairly well placed for this. And even if it doesn't do well, he's going to get a good paycheck out of it. He's back on the small screen. I think it's a very savvy move from a savvy operator.
He is back, to paraphrase his famous quote. Okay, that's Dave Hanratty speaking to us about Arnold Schwarzenegger and FUBAR. Thursday of this week is when you will be able to see that particular series on Netflix. But that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Before I go, actually, though, let me tell you, I forgot to give you the website address for the RHA Gallery. It's rhagallery.ie if you want to find out more about the exhibition that Ola McGowan was talking to us about earlier on. But that now is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Mark McGraw was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. And it's Ray Cuddihy, I believe, tonight once again after the news.